May it please the court, good morning. My name is Chuck Holliday. I represent the appellant, Walter McGill. I'd like to reserve 2 minutes for rebuttal.
Fine.
This court should find that the district court erred in holding that subject matter jurisdiction existed because a court cannot apply neutral principles of law without resolving an underlying dispute over religious doctrine. In the alternative, this court should bar plaintiffs from the relief that they seek under the doctrine of judicial estoppel, and because the complaint failed to state a claim. It's important to note at the outset, Your Honor, that jurisdiction in this case, the plaintiffs bear the burden of establishing jurisdiction. The Supreme Court has held that neutral principles are okay so long as a court does not resolve an underlying property dispute. In Presbyterian Church of the United States.
So long as it does not resolve an underlying property dispute, is that what you meant to say, or an underlying...
Doctrinal dispute. Thank you, Your Honor.
Okay.
An underlying dispute over doctrine. And...
So today, you know, one of the disputes going on out there is the Episcopal Church, and they're not sure who the real Episcopal Church is. So under your theory, one side of that debate could come and seize all of the property of all the churches on the theory that they are the true Episcopal Church, and the side that lost the property couldn't go to court to say they've taken our property and it's ours? And
nope.
The theory being it would force the court to decide who the true church was?
Your Honor, certainly the court can use neutral principles such as trust and property law to determine who's entitled to a church or who's entitled to the robes from a church. And courts have done that for many, many years. But
why
what a court can't
decide,
do...
Why can't we decide who owns the trademark?
Well, because, Your Honor, the trademark in this case is the name of a denomination or religion, and the name of a religion is inherently generic and free for all to use. So a court cannot decide this case not because of the fact that trademark laws provide a neutral grounds of neutral principles that could be used to decide this case. But in applying neutral principles, the court is essentially required to determine who are the true Seventh-day Adventists. The case that the district court relied on most is the Maktab Court out of the Ninth Circuit. And that decision illustrates how a court cannot apply neutral principles without resolving the underlying dispute. In Maktab, the plaintiffs sought to enjoin the defendants from claiming that they were the teachers of, I believe it was called Sufism, and they had several other claims. And the district court actually held that it could not exercise subject matter jurisdiction. On appeal, the Ninth Circuit reversed and said that a court, so long as it applies neutral principles, so long as it frames the issue or stuffs the issues into non-religious issues, can apply neutral principles. And one of the claims for relief in that case was for the who were the official teachers of the religion. And in that case, in the Maktab case, in a footnote, the court noted that it could not decide who the original teachers were. But it said so long as that is subsumed within a false name or origin claim, then it was okay for the court to decide the issue. And, Your Honor, that's where the Maktab court goes astray from the Supreme Court's rulings in this case, is because it says that so long as we can frame it in neutral principles, it's okay if it ends up resolving an underlying dispute. And that's not what the Supreme Court has said. The Supreme Court has said that we must use neutral principles, and they are okay to use so long as it does not resolve an underlying doctrinal issue.
So which Supreme Court case would you say that the Maktab case violates?
It would be, Your Honor, Presbyterian Church in the U.S. versus Mary Elizabeth Blue Hull Memorial Presbyterian Church from 1969. Your Honor, in Zorach versus Clausen, Judge Black dissenting an opinion, he opined that the First Amendment ensures that no organs of government, that no powerful sect can come in and punish dissenters that they can't convert to their faith. And that's exactly what the Seventh-day Adventists have tried, the General Conference, the plaintiffs have tried to do in this case.
Your argument hinges on a dissent?
No, Your Honor, I was just noting his opinion. No, the Presbyterian Church is the actual holding. I was noting an opinion
from... Justice Black was dissenting, and then you started quoting from him.
In Zorach versus Clausen, Your Honor.
Okay.
Just to make a point. I apologize.
It's not, I'm just trying to make sure I understand where you're coming from.
Paragraph 32 of the plaintiff's complaint, they argue the point that the plaintiffs cannot control the quality or the content of the defendant's religious observances. So they're arguing that, they own this trademark, which is the name of a denomination, and therefore they should have the right to use the denomination exclusively.
Well, can a group such as the plaintiffs trademark a denomination as opposed to trademarking a religion?
I think the answer to that question is no, Your Honor. I don't think you can trademark a denomination because if you look at one of the cases cited by the plaintiffs, Purcell versus Summers out of the Fourth Circuit, in that case, two churches had a discrepancy over their names. And the court held that while one church had to have a name that was sufficiently different from the other church, that the names Methodist and Episcopal were generic terms that could not be trademarked. I think most people would agree that Methodist and Episcopal are probably more properly names of denominations than they are religions. And the same is true in this case. Seventh-day Adventism is the name of a religion or denomination.
Okay, let's suppose that you're right, that that you cannot trademark the generic religion, but the plaintiffs could trademark some subgroup that they're creating afresh. How do we put this in the context of this case where the district court has granted a default judgment against you?
Yes, Ron, I think the plaintiffs incorrectly argue that the default judgment disposes of the entire case. What's clear from this court's ruling is that subject matter jurisdiction must be decided before the default judgment can stand. A judgment on a default is a nullity if a court does not have subject matter jurisdiction. And the same is true on a motion to dismiss. If this court finds that the district court erred in denying the motion to dismiss, then the default judgment...
Couldn't a default judgment show that we don't need to decide the issue that involves getting us entangled in religion? That we don't need to get there to the question, even assuming that you're correct, that we're not allowed to decide between generic and trademarking a smaller group?
I'm sorry, Your Honor,
you say in order to get anything in federal court, there must be subject matter jurisdiction, which is generally true. But your client defaulted, and I'm wondering whether the default shows that we don't need to, nor did the district court need to get to the issue that would preclude federal subject matter jurisdiction.
I guess that's a question of does the horse or the cart come first, Your Honor, and I think the answer is that the court has to, for example, if Pastor McGill had never showed up in court, if he allowed a default to be taken against him and then appealed and came to this court and argued there was no subject matter jurisdiction, I think this court could hear that argument and decide that the district court never had subject matter jurisdiction to begin with.
What case would you rely on for that principle?
Your Honor, American Telecom versus Lebanon, 501F3D, Judge Sutton was on that panel, which talks about subject matter jurisdiction being a nullity in that case.
Nick, I may have a misapprehension here. I was thinking that the summary judgment trademark decision was independent of the default judgment and, in fact, predated it.
The summary judgment was granted prior to the default.
So I guess what I'm just trying to make sure I'm understanding, because it all goes back to this jurisdiction to consider the trademark disputes. Even if there's properly a default judgment on the state law claims and some other claims, we have the summary judgment decision on the trademark in front of us, right?
The summary judgment on the trademark is in front of this court, and the state law claims as well, Your Honor. Those claims are, both parties have not argued them extensively, but to the same extent they would be subject to the same principles.
unless they've been defaulted.
Well, but if the court didn't have subject matter jurisdiction to consider those claims, the state law claims being unfair competition or violation of the Tennessee Consumer Protection Act, under the same basis that a court cannot, how could Pastor McGill could not be guilty of violation of the Consumer Protection Act if the plaintiffs had no right to begin with? Under the failure to state a claim defense, the Seventh-day Adventist is the generic name of a denomination. The plaintiffs have gone so far as to admit that and admit that it's a religion. In fact, they argued that to the District Court of Maryland in the Ben case. And we've cited to the brief that they submitted in that case, and on page 37 and 39, they argue the Seventh-day Adventist Church is a religion.
So tell me this way of looking at it. So I think I've grasped your no subject matter jurisdiction because it requires courts to resolve disputes about religion. I'm kind of getting that's what you're saying.
Yes, sir.
Why doesn't the way trademark law works, why isn't that kind of an adequate proxy for protecting and dealing with that problem? And I mean, it's kind of proved by the way you keep describing this. You keep referring to them as generic religions, which of course is exactly the kind of thing not protected by trademark law. So why doesn't trademark law work? I mean, if someone is foolish enough to try to trademark a religion or even some denominations, they're not going to get very far if it's too generic. So that just, let's kind of ignore, forget this subject matter jurisdiction thing. The trademark law is going to protect your client's interests.
Your Honor, I think that trademark law is inadequate because of the reason that the First Amendment protects freedom of religion. And when you look at, for example, the history of religions, people gather together with a common set of beliefs. Over time, as they grow, schisms develop, they break off, they form different churches. As the Supreme Court of Michigan recognized way back in 1897, it's common to take part of the name with you and start a new church. If I were to go down and work at Macy's for a few months and decide to leave Macy's and start a new store and call it slightly better than Macy's or new and improved or reformed Macy's, certainly under trademark law I would have no right to do that. But trademark law needs to recognize the importance of religion and the difference between religion and commercial interests. I think that we generally protect commercial speech, but not in the same manner that we protect religious speech. Your Honors, the World Christian Encyclopedia notes that in 1970 there were approximately a little more than 8,000 denominations. Today there are over 33,000, and we grow another 270 to 300 denominations every single year. What's happened to the plaintiff is exactly what happens to other older religions or denominations. The plaintiffs are a relatively young denomination, and in this case, they have grown to the point to where other people and schisms have developed and they've broken off and they've tried to take the name of the denomination with them. The plaintiffs are certainly entitled to a distinctive name for their church, and but they've not requested that in this case. They've never asked for that. They've asked for an injunction on their trademark, and they're not entitled to that, Your Honors, at the expense of my client's First Amendment rights. Thank you.
Thank you.
Good morning, Your Honors. Joel Gallanter on behalf of the General Conference Corporation of Seventh-day Adventists and General Conference of Seventh-day Adventists. There's a lot to cover here, a lot of different issues, most of which are made moot. They're made moot by the sanctions that were entered by the court due to the defendant's repeated failure to follow court orders. The court had entered three separate mediation orders each time after the first one, and it became an issue warning the parties, and particularly the defendant, that failure to participate would result in sanctions and could result in the sanction of default judgment.
Let me ask you this. Do you think it makes any difference that there's an injunction here? I don't know whether the injunction was issued after he sought to set aside the default or not.
The injunction was entered as part of the default judgment. It was an injunction. I believe it's the Wynn Oil case, Your Honor. It is given almost as a matter of right in a trademark case.
Yeah.
So my clients prevailed on partial summary judgment, which is an important fact because the court did not resolve all of the issues. All of the genericism defenses that the defendant raised were not resolved on summary judgment. Only one mark was resolved on summary judgment, and that was the Seventh-day Adventist mark. And it was summary judgment was granted in our favor on that. While that motion was pending, the judge ordered mediation. After, while we were preparing to mediate, the summary judgment order came down in our partial favor. After that, the defendant indicated he no longer wants to participate in the mediation. Also made some discussions that he may not participate any further in the trial whatsoever, in the case whatsoever. In response to that, this was brought to the court's attention. The court said, no, you have said you would mediate, and I want you to mediate. I think it would be beneficial to the case.
Is it critical that the defendant had agreed to mediate? What if the defendant had never agreed? Would
the court may never, the court may not have thought that it was beneficial to try mediation. But both parties had agreed, and the court started going down that road. The parties started going down that road while we had a trial date set later that year. And the fact that we're here in 2010 establishes some of the prejudice that this was in, I believe, early 2008, over 2 years ago, that this case would have been fully resolved or mediated. And due to the defendants backing out of certain things, we have spent great efforts, money, and time dealing with these issues. The fact that he had agreed did play a part in it.
You started out saying that most of the questions are moot because of the sanctions. And so my understanding is that your position is that because a default judgment was rendered, this court of appeals does not need to decide whether the district court properly granted partial summary judgment. Is that what you're saying?
That is correct, because although it came later.
Why is that? I don't understand that. Go ahead.
Well, Your Honor, you are correct that the summary judgment did stand on its own. We had it was, though, a partial summary judgment. It was an interlocutory order.
Right.
We would have gone to trial, presumably, if mediation wasn't successful. We would have gone to trial on the Adventist mark that is a registered trademark of my clients, and the common law rights to the acronym SDA, which they've been using for decades, if not over a century. That issue is an interlocutory order. Subsequent to that, the court entered default judgment, finding that the defendant is getting default on all issues.
Just so I'm following this, I may just have it wrong, but the way I had it in my head is the partial summary judgment victory for you on the Seventh-day Adventist mark, that's done. Then you're about to go to trial, mediation. Everything else is defaulted is the way I was thinking about it. And, yes, there's a debate about whether that was proper, but the thing I thought was in front of us, regardless of whether the default judgment was proper or not, was the legitimacy of his appealing the partial summary judgment ruling on the Seventh-day Adventist mark. Am I wrong about that?
Right. Well, Your Honor, I think that the partial summary judgment order did stand on its own, but it was subsumed by the subsequent default judgment. And the court himself, the judge himself said this when in filing a motion for stay of the injunction order and the remedies allowed by the default.
What would be the basis for defaulting on and preventing you from appealing an issue that up to that point you dead on everything the right way? I mean, you weren't going to have mediation. The mediation wasn't going to cover the partial summary judgment, was it?
The mediation was as to all issues, and it was an interlocutory order, Your Honor. It was not a final order.
I don't know what that means. That just means you couldn't appeal it right away.
It means we couldn't appeal it, but it's my understanding that any interlocutory order can be reversed by the court at any later date.
The trial judge, the district court, could change his mind on whether he appropriately granted you summary judgment.
That's
partial
correct.
Summary judgment. I thought the district court said something like, the default judgment as a sanction provides an alternative and independent ground on which this court may grant the plaintiff's request for a permanent injunction. So that my understanding is that the district court framed the permanent injunction on the basis of the default judgment affecting the whole case.
Correct, Your Honor. And that maybe what I was trying to get at is that the district judge did say that the default judgment subsumed all issues in the case, even the one that had been partially already decided.
Is there a preliminary injunction either in place or put in place after the partial summary judgment ruling prohibiting plaintiff from using the Seventh-day Adventist mark?
No, there was not, Your Honor. Uh-huh. We asked that in conjunction under both. We said we have dual grounds for an injunction at this point. Uh-huh. One is the sanctions. One is the partial summary judgment motion or order. And we said, as a matter of law, the Sixth Circuit has held that in a trademark case, when infringement has been found, in virtually all cases, injunctive relief is appropriate. So we said, based on that, we should get injunctive relief. Based on the default judgment, we should get
injunctive relief. Ask you why you care. So in other words, what's I mean, I've got to go back and figure out what really happened here. But why would you care if, you know, we review the default judgment, and I guess maybe it's just you'd like to have two arrows in your quiver rather than one. But one way, if we uphold that, I guess you must like it to apply to everything. But why are you worried about our reviewing the partial summary judgment ruling?
Well, we're not worried about your ruling, reviewing the partial summary judgment. We believe that the district court was firmly correct in his ruling on the partial summary judgment on the seventh day Adventist mark.
Isn't there a problem that your opponent didn't brief the default judgment issue in this court, so that if you're correct that the default judgment is dispositive, and if your opponent didn't brief the default judgment issue, then you win automatically?
That is correct, Your Honor. And that I was trying to answer the question that Judge Sutton had asked. But, yes, it is correct that we had fully expected that the default judgment would be an issue on the appeal. The district judge, as I was saying earlier, said when they moved to stay, he said, you're arguing over the trademark claims. The appeal is going to be on the fully dispositive default judgment and the injunction that was entered as a result of that.
And the default judgment would pick up the RFRA arguments too then?
I would assume that it would, yes, Your Honor. So we fully expected that the issue of the propriety of the default judgment and the award that was entered or the sanctions that were entered would be briefed by the defendant, that there would be an issue stated and there would be an argument stated pursuant to that issue in accordance with Federal Rule of Appellate Procedure 28A.
That was not done. The brief of your opponent, the main brief of your opponent, does not have a statement of issues referring to the default judgment.
Does not have a statement of issues.
And doesn't address it. The merits of the default judgment in the body of the brief.
That is correct, and doesn't even address it in the reply brief.
So we would need to decide only whether we had subject matter jurisdiction over the case.
It is our position that is fully dispositive of this appeal.
Okay, so why don't you get to subject matter jurisdiction? Why do we have subject matter jurisdiction?
The Lanham Act, Your Honor. The Lanham Act.
Why is this not an impermissible interference with religion?
The issue under the Lanham Act, as is often the case in many trademark cases, can be genericism. The court has subject matter jurisdiction under the Lanham Act, and then it gets to the genericism issue. That's the case that happens if you're talking about soft drinks, if you're talking about drugs, if you're talking about religious organizations or in groups. The court first has to decide. This is a Lanham Act case. We pled a Lanham Act case in our complaint. We set forth that the court has jurisdiction. We have incontestable registered trademarks that were at issue, the Adventist mark, which the court held there are factual issues still, even despite the registration, and the Seventh-day Adventist mark, which we prevailed on at summary judgment. But we came into court showing we have registered trademarks, strong presumption of validity. That's the Bath and Body Works of this court. Bath and Body Works case of the Sixth Circuit, a strong presumption of validity that we have valid trademark rights. It is then this burden of the defendant to prove genericism. And it's been held by many courts, including this one, that there's a strong burden to bear. That is the attempt that defendant began to make. Defendant partially lost in that attempt on the Seventh-day Adventist mark. The defendant then started thumbing his nose at the court, refused willfully to honor the court's orders, began making public statements about the fact that he wasn't going to honor the court's orders. The court repeatedly warned the defendant, and the defendant continued his actions, and the court finally, after three mediation orders entered default judgment against him, which we claim is fully dispositive of the facts of the case, of the issues on appeal. With respect to the genericism argument, I'm happy to discuss it. We feel that the court was squarely correct on the Seventh-day Adventist mark. The defendant, in its appeal, really kind of ignores or conflates the issues of the different marks. There's an Adventist mark, which the court found was obviously weaker because he found that there would be factual issues that needed to go to trial. And then there's the Seventh-day Adventist mark, which the court found that there were no factual issues presented that rebutted the strong presumption that that was a valid mark, and that the similarities of the mark were met the likelihood of confusion factors. So with respect to Seventh-day Adventist, the plaintiffs, that is the name of the plaintiff's church. It is not a generic mark. The defendant's counsel repeatedly is referring to it as a religion or as a denomination. The denomination is a newer argument. The religion argument was previously made below. But the defendant lost on that argument. The court found that those were that Seventh-day Adventist was not generic. And he pointed to earlier case law in support of that. He referred to the fact that the defendant did not come forward with any type of survey evidence. He relied on his own evidence or his own testimony of what he felt that the term meant. But none of that is sufficient.
Counsel, can I say, this, I just looked at this randomly, so I could be wrong, but I'm looking at page 13 of Judge Breen's May 27th, 09 order. Okay, it looks like it's either the default judgment order or a default judgment order. But the second to last line says, as a sanction for the defense willful failure to comply with the scheduling order, default judgment will be awarded to the plaintiffs on their remaining claims. So it must be at the injunction stage that it somehow became clear that the district court was saying the default applies to all the claims?
He did say that, Your Honor, in that order. He said as to the remaining claims.
Right, so that's what seems to leave the other one outside of it. So when does he bring it back in?
There was after that document, which I believe is the injunction order, and sanctions and injunction order, uh-huh. There was a motion filed by the defendant to stay the injunction. And in that argument, the defendant purely argued trademark arguments and First Amendment arguments, and the court said
that's fine because that extends to the defaulted and previously decided. There were trademark and First Amendment in both, so I don't know what you're making out of that.
Well, the court came back and said those issues are subsumed, essentially, and Judge Moore read the pertinent language, I believe, earlier from the later order of the court in which he said that the...
But just so I'm following, it doesn't seem a little strange to say you've got the injunction order, which says remaining claims, then you've got a stay pending appeal, which purports to expand the scope of the... injunction order?
It is a little strange, Your Honor, and I think part of the issue, it was clarified in our position in a later order, and we relied on that in our briefs or pointed that out in our briefs, but part of the issue, my time is up, am I finished?
But just answer, but make sure you're going to the question I'm getting at. If you're telling me he modified the order, the injunction order, I'm all ears. If all you're saying is his later decisions about staying the earlier injunctions and dispositive motions decisions during appeal, if that's when the clarification happened, that seems highly unusual to me.
Wasn't there another passage? I think, Judge Sutton, you said you were quoting from page 7. And
page 13 of page 13. The May 27th order.
Okay. There may be other passages in that order.
Well, this is the conclusion. This is where, you know, as a sanction for the defendant's willful failure to comply with the scheduling order, default judgment will be awarded to the plaintiffs on their remaining claims.
Right, Your Honor.
Well, maybe this is what I'm missing. The sentence before that says the court adopts the magistrate judge's report and recommendation. Does the magistrate judge's report and recommendation say as a sanction for the default everything is wiped out or just the remaining claims?
I believe it's not entirely clear. I'd have to go back to the report and recommendation. It may be a little bit clearer on that point, Your Honor. But I think part of the issue is that the relief on the decided claim and the remaining claims is completely overlapping. I mean, they're both they're both trademark infringement claims. One is for the Adventist mark, one is for the Seventh-day Adventist mark, and then there's also the SDA mark that was still in the remaining camp. But pursuant to the decided issues or pursuant to the issues that had to go through a full trial, we were going to be seeking the same relief. We were going to be seeking an injunction that was going to prevent them from using these terms, these trademark terms, in a trademark sense. Not in a descriptive sense, and as the injunction order says, that they can use it in their services. They can speak these terms. They can explain that they believe in the advent of Christ and those type of things, but they can't use them in a trademark sense. So I think part of the confusion is that we were seeking the same relief for two different reasons. I agree that the court's language that you just pointed to wasn't entirely clear if these are two separate standalone.
Actually, it was clear. Remaining claims.
Remaining claims, correct, Your Honor. But then in a subsequent order on the judge. On the stay, the judge pointed back to that order and said that that order is fully dispositive of all issues on appeal, all of the claims, and I'm paraphrasing the language. But
whoever has a situation where the defendant loses something, and you know, at that point he's lost 8 out of 10 things, and then the defendant seeks a stay on appeal and now loses 10 out of 10 things in the course of the stay on appeal motion, that's just very strange. It's almost like you're penalizing the defendant for trying to stay the order during appeal. Because up to that point, it seems to me it's crystal clear the injunction, the default judgment does not apply to the previously decided partial summary judgment ruling. And that's still in play to try to appeal. Tell me I'm wrong, but I'm just telling you, from the conclusion of the order, I don't know how you could read it any other way. And it just seems very strange that when the defendant permissibly seeks a stay on appeal, he now loses more.
I don't think that the court was trying to say that you're losing more. I think that the court was saying in the sanctions orders, you've lost everything. Because I don't think the court was trying to get at, you still can appeal the summary judgment separately from this. I think the court was saying, you have lost everything. I don't think he was getting at, in that order, the issue that you're currently getting at, Your Honor.
I see.
And in our opinion, that clarification came later. It wasn't that he took more away. He was just clarified on that language.
Thank you. Unless there are any other questions?
No. Thank you, Your Honors.
Your Honor, the default judgment is an abuse of discretion standard. And Pastor McGill admits that he engaged in civil disobedience. I don't think he probably has a legal argument as to that the judge abused his discretion in entering the default, except that he disagrees overall with any of the claims that the plaintiffs have sought, the unfair competition, the Consumer Protection Act. All of those claims we've argued and appealed as well are the subject.
How can you appeal if you defaulted, if you failed to engage with the court processes? So regardless of whether the district court is perfectly clear as to whether the default pertained to the summary judgment, partial summary judgment ruling or not, once a party fails to comply with the district court orders, isn't that really the end of the case? The defendant, in your instance, loses.
No, Your Honor, not if the court didn't have jurisdiction to begin with because the complaint failed to state a claim as to all of those issues. If a defendant doesn't defend in a different jurisdiction and a default judgment is entered against him, he can attack that on appeal even though he never showed up and participated in the process.
So your point is that even though there's been a default by your client, you can say this district court did not have subject matter jurisdiction, and therefore this district court's judgment is worthless.
Exactly, Your Honor. And regardless of what happened at the district court level, this court can invoke the doctrine of judicial estoppel. Again today, the plaintiffs shy away from what's the name of their denomination. And if this court...
If we were to decide that there is subject matter jurisdiction, don't you lose?
Not if the court decides that the complaint failed to state a claim. We can still win.
When what case says that you can raise failure to state a claim as a defense to a default judgment?
Your Honor, I would cite U.S. versus Consus, 507 F3D 1028, 2007.
Can you say that again? I'm sorry.
Yes, Your Honor. U.S. versus Conces, 507 F3D 1028, a default and a failure to state a claim is not a bar on appeal.
Okay.
I believe I'm out of time.
Thank you. It's an interesting case. Thank you both for your argument. The case will be submitted.